Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening.
That's fine.
Excuse me. Always good to start off with a cough.
Yes, sir.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Shop, home of the Band of Traders podcast. I am your host, Kyle, and today's guest is Rick Kosha, strategic asset manager for Quincy, Massachusetts. Now, not only is Rick the best-dressed guest I think we've ever had, but he's also had quite the impressive career before he decided to push Eric's crazy projects over the finish line. I had Eric on Friday, so he kind of gave us a couple of little sneak peeks behind the curtain there, what actually goes on in Quincy. So I'm hoping we get the real story about things like the pension obligation bond, maybe, or
absolutely
the municipal bond that you guys that we did. What was that in April? I came out there and talked to you guys about.
Yeah, the blockchain bond.
Yeah, who sold that?
So we were the issuers on that. So it was a $10 million blockchain bond. That the funding was for kind of, you know, it's kind of a lot of the blocking and tackling that cities do, which is streets, sidewalks, paving. Yeah, yeah. So, and, you know, water lines. And so the JP Morgan Chase was the underwriter on that. And they were said, not only were they the underwriter, but they actually took down the deal. So they bought the bonds on their platform, on their Onyx digital debt service platform. And they still own the bonds as we sit here today. So they're still owners of
them. But there's a moment where before the bond is sold, somebody has to look up and say that they accept that price or that the sale is going through, correct?
That is correct. Okay. That is correct. I see where you're going. you've obviously spoken to Eric, but I sold the bonds. I managed the debt for the city. I appreciate the kind of walking me to the finish line on that. But yeah, I sold the bonds. But as you know, this was a cliche, but it was a team effort. It was something that you're right.
Eric's knew you were to say that.
Yeah, but it's true. That is true. I've said this. I think, Kyle, I think you and I have talked about this before. And my name is a strategic asset manager. That's the title of my job description.
Right.
But I think a lot of the strategic stuff is done at the mayor's level, Mayor Tom Koch and Eric Mason, the chief financial officer. Yes, I'm intimately involved in it, but I think my job is to tactically day-to-day get what needs to be done so that the objectives are met. So I think strategic is a little bit of a misnomer, because I think of strategic as 30,000 foot level, like this is what we want to accomplish, this is how we want to do it, this is what's going to be doing.
Right,
the tactical is, okay, now we have to get it done. How do we, and I think I kind of, not to pat myself, I think I excel at that and making sure, all right, let's avoid the noise and let's get this done, because there's a lot of talking going on. But I'm sorry, I totally got you off topic on that.
No, you're right. But that's exactly what Eric was saying. Like, you were the guy that, if you weren't on the team, none of these projects would have been done, including like the pension obligation bond. I didn't realize you were so involved in that one either.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true, and I think that's for a lot of reasons. I think it's probably because of my background that I'm comfortable working with underwriters and financial advisors and bond attorneys, and I know the industry, and I know I have a comfort level with the markets and when's a good time to get out.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it's bandwidth, though. You know, Kyle, I think when the mayor hired me 4.5 years ago, he had a vision for this department. He wanted to do a lot of things. You know, one of them was, as you mentioned, was addressing the unfunded pension liability of the city, which at the time, for those who know pensions out there, you know, there's a big crisis going on in unfunded pensions. Which is a little bit of a ticking time bomb. And we were, I think, about, I'm going to get this ratio wrong, but I think we were about 35% funded, which is pretty bad, pretty bad. So, you know, you get to a point in Massachusetts where, if you know, you've got until, I think it's 2040, basically, that the plan has to be fully funded. And if they don't, if it's not the state, if they don't see that you will do it, the state will come in and take it, and they'll just absorb the plan. Yeah.
Right.
So the mayor's, to your point, yeah, so the mayor wanted to address this. This has been an underfunded problem for quite some time before his tenure, too. So we took the bold initiative, and I say we, as it was the mayor and Eric and myself, to issue a pension obligation bond. Now, the issue with a pension obligation bond is what you're essentially doing is you're issuing a bond that you have it's a liability. Now you've turned it into a full-blown solidified debt that you have mm-hmm. to service every month,
quarter, year,
every quarter. Yeah, well, I shouldn't say every month. Two times a year, we have pension and interest costs.
Yeah.
Now the pension obligations bond over the years have been fairly controversial because you know you'll have treasurers out there to say like it's too dangerous. What happens if the market goes against you? You know, you're basically betting on an arbitrage, right? You're taking something that you have a flexible liability on. And now you're solidifying it, and you're locking in what your debt rate is going to be. Now, we would just happen to do this during a period of historically low interest rates. This is where the math works. Whereas, if the interest rate on the debt service is actually lower than what your pension is going to be generating for those assets that are invested in the market, there's your win right there. That margin is banked, and then you know you can continue on make the liability payments and stay fully funded. Now, when rates are really high, that's why they haven't been done for a period. There was a period last, like I said, over the last 4 years where they were in vogue. We took mm-hmm. advantage of it. But if the rates are high, it's a much more difficult hurdle to make
right. because there's less incentive for even doing that.
There's less incentive to do it, and you could ultimately have a deeper hole if the assets don't perform the way they should, and they don't meet that 6%, 7% discount rate, in which is that's what the portfolio has to make. Your unfunded ratio can actually go down, so it's a tricky yeah.
I do want to ask,
please,
who sold that bond?
But this is actually a true statement. The city of Quincy sold that bond. You know, the chief financial officer has to sign off on it. But in terms of working out the structure, working with the financial advisors, working with the underwriters, and when going to market, myself and Eric, by directive of the mayor, sold that bond in 2021, I believe it was, December of 2021.
And Eric was the one who raised his hand and said sold, or you did?
Well, I was on the call that accepted the payment. So.
You're going to tell me eventually.
You must have been an attorney in another life, Kyle. I looked at your background, not your background, but you're a leading questioner, which is good. You're a good interviewer.
Let me ask you this though, sure. Or let me at least compliment you on this, because it sounds like you had an out. If you would have just let that unfunded thing get to whatever that trigger point was, and then the state would have taken it over for you, and then that would have been off of your plate.
It would, but it also affects your credit rating for the city. I mean, you are penalized. It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for a municipality to basically be co-opted by the state, because it's basically saying you can't manage your liability. So if you miss one of those payments, it's a significant hit to your credit rating, which, as you know, Kyle, like Standard & Poor's, which is the rating agency we use. They're rating your financial health, right? So they're rating the bonds, because when we go to sell bonds, S&P will assign a rating to it. Yes, you're still a AA+, you're AA negative. And that is what the investors go out and look at and say, oh, okay, the creditworthiness of this municipality is a good bet. They can pay for their expenses. They have enough revenue. Their financial house is in shape. And and when I say financial house, your pension, your property taxes, your excise tax, all those are in line. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm going to buy $20-30 million worth of their bonds.
And then also having that good rating is also going to help you get a better rate for you guys too.
Exactly.
Don't have to incentivize as much for people to take on the extra risk.
Absolutely. And to kind of the point that you were making was, if you can't make that liability a pension liability, which is a massive hole, the mayor always says, when he does his budget every year, the two things he has right off the dock is his health, the health insurance for the city, and the pension liability. That eats up probably half his budget. He knows that in terms of his budget, he's got a budget for the debt service and he's got a budget for health insurance as well. Mm-hmm. Now, you're right. You could say, like, look, we, you know, you could let it go and you let the state take it over. But that is going to significantly impact the creditworthiness of the city, and it makes borrowing that much more difficult for the city going forward in favorable terms, and just attracting potential investors who would buy your bonds. Because, look, you've already, it's like defaulting on your house, your mortgage, right? That it's the same thing, except it's drastically, you know, not to say
You got to be pretty underwater to go that route.
It's a bad thing. Yeah. And there are, there are some communities that have done it. Not a lot, but yeah, it's the be the blast resorts. So
I could see some municipalities in Illinois probably considering that route, but
you're absolutely right. Absolutely. Illinois had a massive unfunded liability. Yeah.
You mentioned like the payments of those being like one of the trickiest things, like, cause we learned from the last time I talked to you guys about how the payments on these are some of the most, I don't know, stressful periods in probably your guys' time. If those miss their deadlines by even hours.
That's a default. Yeah, it's absolutely. So we work really closely. This is where I'm going to throw props to our treasurer's office. You know, I know what all my debt payments are every mm-hmm. month. I look at it, you know, I know exactly what they're for. They're for water, they're for the pension, they're for... and you're absolutely right. They have to be in by a day at a certain time. And, you know, I like to say, like, if I, you know, I would never miss a payment, forget that we have one scheduled, but we also have a treasury that keeps online. It does happen. And, you know, you bring up an interesting point. We recently, where this almost happened was we recently did when I started, one of the things the mayor wanted to do, and he asked Eric and I to do, was to review our banking relationships. I'm going to try to fast forward. Review our banking relationships. He wasn't happy with mm-hmm. some of the depository accounts we had. And he said, look, we need to do better. So we did. We reshuffled our banking roster. And we Santander is our primary bank right now. So the first, now I'm fast forwarding. They're on board. All the systems are in place. We were due for a debt payment this one month about 2 years ago. And they have to be in by a certain period. We have to have in by 11 because that's when our custodians expect mm-hmm. the money. So what happens is now, this is why we did the blockchain, because I think this is where it's going.
Yes.
The issuer will send a payment in. It'll go to a custodian. And then it will go to DTC, which is kind of the housing platform.
Like the clearinghouse.
Actually, I'm getting that backwards. It goes to DTC first. Then it goes to our custodian, and they distribute the payments to the investors. Well, this one time with Santander, there was a misunderstanding of when those payments had to go out. And I remember this from my banking years, is they were still kind of in limbo at 11 o'clock.
Ooh.
And we were scrambling. Molly Smith, who our treasurer, she does a great job. You know, she was on the phone saying, look, it's left our systems or our accounts. It's sitting on your accounts. It's got to go out and it's got to hit by the state. So, you know, we got it done, but there was a lot of like head scratching as to why this was. And their reasoning was they thought it had to be out by 1 o'clock. They typically do all their wires because the funds are obviously wired and checks don't go out. They're obviously wired by 1 o'clock, which is a banking standard. Because like I said, I worked in the bank industry. Yeah. I worked for JP Morgan for years. And I think typically what a lot of banks do is they aggregate their wires and say, okay, they're all going out because they're all going out by 1 o'clock, because if they go out by 1 o'clock, they're received same day, which is great.
Yeah.
But a municipality is a little bit different. We're not just trying to get money to investors. These are all expected to be paid by that time. And if it's late to your larger point, that's considered being late on your mortgage payment. That's considered being late on a significant liability. So there would have been a lot of, and that's a black mark. You were late
right.
on a debt service payment. But we have since, you know, remedied that. Everyone's on the same page.
And that was one of the major benefits of the blockchain Onyx platform that JP Morgan's put together. Is there a way to move any of the existing bonds onto that platform, or is it only going to be new releases?
It would be new releases. So it would be difficult. It would be difficult to, you know, take those on and put them on the current platform.
Sure, it would be nice, though.
Yeah. Well, this is why we did the blockchain deal, is I think what will ultimately happen. Because to the spirit that you're getting to, Kyle, is that with blockchain, it's all digitized, and there is no essentially middleman. There is no DTC.
You described at least two or three middlemen that you're cutting out of there.
Exactly. You have the custodian, and then you have DTC.
And nobody touches a product and makes it cheaper to the end consumer.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And the great thing is this is all done real time, so it isn't that you're waiting for someone to accept funds. I mean, you can that you know when we release them, you can see them actually funds being released and going into those accounts. So yeah, it's a much more fit now. You know, we were the first to do it, and it's great. We've gotten a lot of kudos, and there's a lot of interest. But there's a lot of work that has to be done. That secondary market has to be built, because what happens is what will typically happen in a municipal deal is that underwriter will buy those bonds, but they, as you know, Kyle, they're selling those bonds almost immediately on the secondary market. So,
just like the mortgage,
yes, same model, right. Same model. So you have to have that secondary market. You have to know, like, oh, and that's how you can get a little bit more favorable pricing when you can kind of negotiate the pricing. You know, the underwriters will take it at a certain price, but they'll sell it to another player at a certain price, and that's how they rationalize it. That's not there yet on blockchain, because when we did blockchain, the sale, it was a private and permissioned platform that we used. It was JP Morgan's platform. So
yeah,
you could buy those bonds if you were permissioned to be on that, and you had a custodial relationship with JPM.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot of interest. There was a lot of interest, and I think they're working with a few players to get them finalized. But at the time of the deal, we weren't there yet.
I got the impression that JP Morgan, I think, wanted to just have the transaction done just to prove that all the tech worked. They weren't necessarily ready to stick other people on there yet.
That's fair. I think that's true. But I also think, like, if ABC, if a Goldman Sachs or whomever said, yeah, we want to take part in this deal, they would try to move heaven and earth to get them platformed or on the platform.
You think?
I think so, yeah. and Goldman Sachs is a bad example, actually, Kyle, because they have their own, they were a direct competitor to JPM, and they have their own digitized platform too, which is an interesting sidebar, is that when we were doing this deal, the mayor wanted to get it done at a certain time. We wanted to get it done at a certain time. But the reason we wanted to get it done as quickly as possible is because Goldman Sachs was very close to finalizing a blockchain deal too. And the whole, listen, there's all the efficiencies and all the savings and cost savings associated with are all great, and they're all going to occur. But if you're going to take that plunge, you kind of want to be first. You don't want to be second.
There's right? a lot of ancillary benefits that come from that. Now, how many other phone calls have you gotten from people exploring this? Like, I guarantee you guys are going to have your finger on the pulse when the second one comes out.
Yeah, we've had a lot. I've had colleagues from my previous life in the investment management field, specifically on the fixed income side, obviously, because these are munis, who have been kicking the tires.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think they've, and I've kind of directed them to JPM, because, you know, they're obviously the tech experts on this. But no, you're not wrong. And the larger question too, and you probably want to get him on your show one of these times.
Isaac Sine.
Yeah, I could probably get
from there.
Yeah, I think Isaac. The problem with investment management firms is that I always say they're the most highly regulated industry in the world.
Trying to get anyone to say anything.
I could, you know, I could tell you stories that you're just extremely regulated.
You got to get them after they're done working there.
That's the thing. But they have fielded a lot of calls. They've had a lot of interest on, look, how did this go? You know, tell us a little bit about it. And I do know there are two or three firms, larger firms, you know, firms you would recognize, who are they're working really closely with to get them platformed on the Onyx platform.
Oh, speaking of Goldman Sachs, and there, I think I know which project you're talking about, and I don't know how much of that is public knowledge, so I'm not going to speak too much about it. But why hasn't that? If they're that close, you would have thought that they would have completed theirs by now. Did they?
Yeah, I'm gonna totally butcher this, but I think the larger. So what JPM did really, really well when they were doing our deal, you can never go fast enough, but they really engaged with the SEC and the MSRB early on, because they knew this was going to be a slog. This was going to be the first time which was ever done. So there was no template. Like, what type of disclosures do you have to have on the offering statement? Right. What is the liability? What if they have, you know, Kyle, like, just even the most mundane things, like, well, not really mundane, but if the city of Quincy releases funds, but for some reason the Onyx platform goes down and those payments, those debt payments aren't uncompleted because of the technical difficulties on JPM's side, who's on the hook? Is it JPM?
What's the backup plan?
And what's the backup plan? And they did, I worked for them for several years, and they did that. They were really upfront with that and really engaging with all the bodies that they needed to make sure that the regulatory, as well as all the, you know, disclosure and just all the backup work was done, so that when we were ready to pull the trigger, I mean, you know, Kyle, I'm sure Eric told you, because, you know, I think we've had conversations. This was a probably 9 to 10 month,
yeah,
be a little bit longer in the making.
Oh yeah,
and that wasn't just testing and making sure the system, which system worked, but it was just getting the regulators on our side, on the USA, comfortable with the transaction.
New stuff and regulators, they get very, very puckered when they see
do.
That.
Yeah, they do. They do. I mean, that's, you know, they're all lawyers.
is that what it is?
It's funny. So we got the concept of doing this 2 years ago. Well, at the last Boston Blockchain Week.
Oh, okay.
When we had Paolo Bordelon, who was the CFO of Lugano, Switzerland. And they've done several of these.
Oh, really?
And yeah. The contrast is, in Europe, the you know, the securities regulators are a lot less stringent. Yeah, like they've done a lot more municipals. Now, on the corporate side, there's a lot more corporate issuances, yeah, that have been done overseas. But yeah, this is the first one here. And the major reason is because it's a new transaction and it's a new way of transacting or selling municipal bonds. That's never been done.
I think it's the key municipal you just said there. I mean, government doesn't tend to be the adopters of technology right out of the gate.
No, you're absolutely right.
They want systems that are proven to work before they start investing in it or using it.
That's right. And as you know, municipalities are just by nature risk averse, right?
Yes. Yeah. Which is so impressive to see a municipality be the one to take the plunge. And of course, it's got to be someone like Quincy, right?
Yeah. I've been pleasantly surprised at how, like I said, we have a chief financial officer who's a young guy who's really embraces technology, or really embraces ways of doing efficient.
I heard a rumor about him. I heard a rumor that he added an E to his name just so he'd show up ahead of you on the alphabetical list. Is that true?
I will kind of confirm or deny that.
His name used to be Rick Mason, but he changed it.
but he really embraces technology, and he's, you know, and I don't want to keep blowing smoke up my, you know, my colleagues, but like, I think if you had a different chief financial, I know this is true. If you had, none of this would occur. Like, we would never explore this. The technology, mm-hmm, in this office would not be where it is. I mean, you have to have a mayor who has the vision,
yes,
too, who he sees it. And he's always like, how can we do things better? How can we do things faster? How can we do things that get more people involved? And that was one thing I left out was, you know, we think it's really cool because it's the first, and you know, we're really utilizing technology to be more efficient in how we transact business. But the mayor had another goal, and his goal was, look, we sell a lot. We're a frequent issuer in the market. We have over $1 billion in debt, not long term, but long term and short term.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're a desirable issuer because we're AA rated, have significant tax levy, where, you know, we're well financially managed.
Yes.
But the mayor always had a thought, like, look, we're building a new Swamp School, elementary school. We're building new infrastructure, you know, and I always get questions as to how can I buy those bonds as a constituent?
Yeah.
You know, if I live in Swanham, which we'll be building a new school, you know, I'm going to send my kids to school there. It'd be great. I'd be able to invest in my community and also get, you know what, I'll get tax exempt savings from the municipalities.
Use that to pay my property tax.
And then use that to pay my property tax. And that was what he was driving at. He called it the democratization of selling, issuing debt, that the everyday smaller investor could take part in. Now, this doesn't do that. It does open it up to Listen, if you were a high net worth client and you wanted to buy Quincy Bonds and you were on the JP Morgan, you could have absolutely bought those bonds. But the way munis are sold now, again, I know I'm speaking to someone who follows the markets, that it's kind of a niche asset class, right? So, you know, it's not very sexy. You know, you're going to get your 4%, 5% yield, which is great, but that's tax exempt. So think about it. Who's the investor that wants that 4%, 5% tax exempt, you know, yield when the market's generating 20% returns this year?
Anybody who doesn't want the risk.
Anyone who doesn't or doesn't need the risk, right? Yeah. If you're a high net worth client, you're like, look, I've got critical mass. Yeah. I'm not worried about growth. I'm not worried about income. I'm worried about how do I take my assets and invest them in a way that I'm not going to get hammered at the end of the year. It's, well, municipal debt is how you do it. And that's why that's always been the niche asset class in terms of the individual. Now you have bond funds, mutual funds. You have insurance companies who buy a crap load of municipal debt because that's how they manage their liabilities, right? They do liability matching. So they've got all these premiums they're taking in, and they've got to pay out the, you know, on claims. This is how they kind of match. If I know I'm going to get 5% on my yields and I'm paying out X amount, this is, they call it liability-driven investing. So they're a major buyer of municipal bonds, you know, mutual funds, investment management companies, insurance companies, and high net worth investors.
They can't say enough highs on there.
Yeah, you're right, right.
I've heard.
And this is basically the first step to kind of like opening up that market, we think.
So when's the next one going to be, do you think?
There will be a next one. I can confidently say that. We were hoping to do one fairly soon. And we were hoping to do one as it relates to some of these school projects.
When you do the second one, then, is the plan to be able to have the secondary market for those ones too?
Yes.
That way other people can?
Yes. And we were also going to follow the same blueprint. We were going to have JPM do it because they're essentially the safest and best option on the market right now.
Yeah.
But the way we wanted to do it was we wanted to ensure that there would be an opportunity for retail investors to buy it, to buy our bonds. And JPM's close, but they're not there yet as it relates to supporting the retail custodian relationship. Now, the way we envisioned it anyway, Kyle, and this may change, but, you know, we looked at it as, all right, is there a way that, it, you know, if they can't support somebody just saying, well, I get $5,000, I want to invest, you know, it's usually the ask is usually a bit higher. Is there a way of having another a local custodian, let's say a local bank, have that custodial relationship with JP Morgan on their Onyx platform, pull in assets from different investors who are interested in it. Mm-hmm. And then they would ultimately be the buyer of those, they were the buyer of the funds, of the bonds, and then kind of distribute it that way.
So less of a point to point, and there'd still be.
Right.
Like the ideal way would be that I can just log into my computer, click a button, and then have a piece. But we know that that's
exactly
not necessarily the easiest way to implement things.
That's not. But I think that we'll. I think it will ultimately get there,
yeah.
Kyle.
That's the ultimate end goal, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to meet this timeline and to meet this time frame again, as an ambitious guy, he's got ambitious plans.
Right.
We wanted to again go back to JPM and go back to Onyx. And it was just a matter of like, you know, we're close, Rick, but we're not there yet as it relates to kind of the disclosures needed and the systems needed to support individual investors. But again, this is the first step you take towards doing that and opening it up. You do more of these deals, they open up their systems a little bit more, they provide additional services that support those things. So
Fuck, I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. That's all right.
I must not have been important.
But that is on, like I said, the, to your question, that is on the radar screen. And I know you're not quoting me, but I wouldn't be surprised if it does happen like next year, 2025.
Yeah, I think that's the timeline Eric was looking at.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool, though. I hope that, that was the question I had. The one that we just had done, you guys were waiting on a report to see if there was any learnings to glean from the first one that y'all did. Did you guys get that report back yet?
I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen it yet, Kyle. I don't think Eric's gotten it yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I think just anecdotally, I think one of the things we've learned is the secondary market is a big part of it, right? You have to have willing partners, and being the first, a lot of people took risks. You know, I was involved in a conference that our bond council held 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. Block Lord. They did a fantastic job. And some of the questions were, Well, why did you do it? Like, why did you do it? And, you know, did you see efficiencies? Did you see savings, significant savings? And did you see kind of, you know, speed of transaction? Now, I would say we definitely saw efficiencies. We definitely saw speed. The savings, were, you know, the deal cost what it would potentially have cost if we had just done a competitive deal, a negotiated deal.
But you guys knew that going into it.
Right. And it was competitive. If it was outrageous, I always tell them, yeah, it's like, look, if I would have put the brakes on this thing. If we were going to sell $10 million worth of bonds and it was going to cost us 3% more by doing it, I would have said, man, it's hard to justify that, you know. But we worked really closely with our advisors, with our underwriters, and with our bond counsel to make sure it happened. So that's what I would say. I would go in eyes wide open, knowing, look, you know, maybe you're not going to meet all your objectives at first, but you can't look at, like, and again, Kyle, and you and I have had this conversation. You can't look at being the first at something. You're not going to realize all the benefits. You're doing this because you see you're playing the long game and you see what the ultimate benefits are. And I have no qualms about saying that, like, this is ultimately will be the future of the way bonds are issued and bonds are sold. I just think that's the natural progression of technology. We've seen it in every other transaction, right? Whether it's, you know, buying securities and investing, working with advisors, you know, you have robo advisors now. Now anybody can sell. So, you know, 40 years ago, you needed a 40, 50 years ago, you needed a broker to buy securities, not anymore. And you had to pay a commission for the purchase and the sale. And, you know,
remember the commission used to be like $50 for every transaction?
Exactly. And you tell that to anyone under, you know, 30 or under now, like, what are you talking about? I'm just jumping on Schwab and I'm just going to buy, you know.
Has the metals market just not caught up? Is the metals, because my dad was talking to me about buying a bunch of silver the other day, and I was trying to explain to him that with the way the spot price works, like, it's dumb to buy the metal itself because you're losing, you're taking a haircut when you go to sell it when you go to buy
That's
it.
That's right.
Buy silver stocks or mining companies or something.
That's right. You want to buy the derivative of, like, on the metals of that security, right? Of the commodity, I should say.
Has the metals market just never gotten past or never had that maturation that, like, the stock and equities markets had?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I also think, I think you go back to the secondary market. The secondary market's a little bit spottier than the equities market, right? The liquidity is just... The liquidity is what can drive down costs on a type of transaction. You know,
I've watched the silver futures market and it's thin.
Right, exactly. Yeah, okay. And that's the biggest driver. And it's just, you know, it always goes back to expenses and liquidity and how much or how broadly a security trades.
So stocks probably got a big boost when everything went digital then, that injected a large amount of liquidity and then allowed the prices to come down for the participants.
I think that's a fair description.
It's like, who's still buying spot gold and spot silver? What are you doing?
You're just throwing
money away. You might as well light it on fire.
Like, right. Are you like, who are you buying gold? Are you really buying a kind of, you know, a warehouse full of gold? And no, you're buying
that. Right.
You're buying the contract on that to purchase it at that price.
Oh, God, the prepper. I was talking to somebody about, like, what do you do if the market crashes completely and goes to zero? I was like, I don't really care. Money's worthless at that point. That's why I have guns and ammo.
Right. No, you know, those aren't bad things to have.
Right.
But I sure as hell
don't want gold if the market or the economy goes to complete and utter crap and we
you've got bigger problems.
Off.
You've got bigger problems.
Right.
In your portfolio.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, I didn't mean to derail us.
Not at all.
Let's talk a little bit about you then. I think we covered most of the business end stuff.
Sure.
Are you from Quincy?
Oh, yeah. Born and bred.
So you left as a kid, then came back?
No, I always did. I worked for the longest time. I always worked in the greater Boston area.
Oh, really? Okay.
In different roles.
You traveled a bit.
I did travel. I did, in my roles, I traveled a bit. Yeah, so... It was all, you know, it was international as well as domestic. And no, I always loved the area, and I went to school here in Boston. I got my undergrad at the University of Massachusetts, got my MBA from Suffolk University.
You know Ken Mooney there?
I know the name, yeah.
He's the guy, he teaches some of the blockchain stuff. We did an interview with him of the Boston Blockchain Week.
Oh, small world, yeah.
Actually, it was funny because he was in there using the restroom, and some guy walked by. It was one of his students that was pitching for one of the presentations for the Blockchain Week, and it was his student there, and like, Apparently that happens to him all the time. I guess he runs into his old.
I bet that was it through that. I mean, they do a great job of blockchain. I think you need to get on the speaker circuit next year, Kyle.
Me, I don't know. Are you kidding me? I'm surprised nobody realized I don't know shit about blockchain.
Well, I don't know. I've spoke to a few. I mean, there's a lot of newbies there too. And I think.
Well, I think we did a good job of trying to keep it approachable too. We didn't try to nerd out too much on the tech.
No. I thought there was a nice job. But yeah, so I've worked in the, again, you've heard this boring story, I know, off camera, but
boring. But...
You know, I've worked about 25 years in the investment management field. You know, I worked for some of the larger firms, Fidelity Investment, on the institutional side. And for those who are listening who don't know, you know, you have the retail side, what we talked about, which is the individual investor, kind of the smaller investors, and then you have the institutional side where. You know, investors are quite large. You're managing pensions and endowments and foundations and corporate plans.
When you say institutional, does that mean not individuals then at that point? Does that mean all entities, like corporates or some other type of structure?
Yeah, exactly. It's usually corporates. I mean, there is institutional investment management is a little bit different in that, you know, when you want to buy a security or a mutual fund, you know, you're going to buy something, quote unquote, off the shelf, right? This is what we offer. You're buying a growth fund and it invests in the U.S. 65%, and this is kind of what the performance range has been. This is the risk profile of it. This is kind of what the standard deviation, and that's what you're buying. You know, this is the manager on that fund. This is the securities it'll hold. There's a number of securities it'll hold, et cetera, et cetera. It's all boilerplate. Well, an institutional investor, if you're, if you're Google, let's say, and you say, look, we have a corporate endowment, or we have a corporate plan, retirement plan, and we have $50 billion in it. And we want some of this money to be managed, you know, domestically. We want some of it to be managed internationally. We want some of it to be managed in fixed income and equity, small cap, large cap. Well,
do they come with you with all those requirements, or do you put a plan together for them and say, look, this is how we'll split up this money?
No, excellent question. So usually what will happen is they'll have a need, right? They'll say, look, they may already have a plan in place, and they say, like, look, we're managing this for growth, and we've got these 20 managers. These are our growth managers. These are our small cap managers. These are our fixed income managers. And we need to replace three of these. So you know what you're going in for. We're going in to bid for a slice of the large cap mandate of that plan. Sometimes they don't know. Sometimes they'll just say, sometimes they'll know, because some of these boards are, you know, fairly sophisticated that manage this aspect of their plan. And they'll say, look, we're just looking for, we've got $50 billion. And this was actually a real example. And we just need, you know, we just want cash management. We just want this in short duration instruments. And what we're going to use this for is we're just using this fund to kind of fund our operations or fund our liability. So we just want, we're looking for yield. We're looking for low risk, and we're looking for competency and how to do that.
Basically just came to you and said, we have $50 billion that we don't know what to do with. Can you find a home for it?
Yeah. So that was like a cash management. And the problem with that is, I don't say the problem, but the dynamic with that type of management is it's, you know, investment managers get paid on fees, right? So if you're, if you're managing a $50 billion plan, and you've got, and Kyle, a lot of these plans have multiple managers. So Fidelity's not going to get, you know, I just keep using Fidelity, but firm ABC is not going to get all $50 million. They may get, they could potentially, it's rare though, but they may get a sleeve of it. You're going to get $10 billion and you're going to do our U.S. equity portion. You're going to do our international portion.
Right. That makes sense.
So, you know, there's a significant fee that's...
Well, it's a smart move because you're not only diversifying your markets, but you're also diversifying your managers too.
You're diversifying your managers, absolutely. And you're diversifying your, the enterprises that are doing that. And, competition is good, right? So, which goes to my larger point is why someone would kind of, you know, take that mandate of like 50 whatever, then billions of dollars in just cash management, which is a very, 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 very low fee management. Mm-hmm. Because what are you doing, right? You're putting it in treasuries. You're putting it in, you know, very low risk, low volatile, not high income or not high return generating vehicles. But
can you loan that overnight at the risk free rate?
Yeah, exactly. But the play is that, you know, I don't say play in a derogatory way, but you're hoping that you build that relationship. So over time that they may have other needs that they can say, mm-hmm. look, you did a great job with this. We're looking to revamp our retirement plan, our 401k plan, or, you know, we have an endowment and we'd like you to do it. So that's why you do it. But because the work that is needed, the administrative work, the back office work, you know, the relationship management work that's involved in kind of managing that plan or that client is significant. You know?
Yeah. Do you ever get to place any orders, or do you have to, how does that work? Or a client wants you to like place an investment. How does that work? What does that process look like?
Going back to like the individual versus the retail versus the institutional. So institutional, the client has a lot more say in how those mm-hmm. assets are managed, right? So, you know, you buy a mutual fund, right? And, you know, it's got an investment guidelines and it's got an objective and it's got, you know, disclosures. Well, you're basically for an institution, they can kind of work with the investment managers to decide what they want to, how they want to manage. So they may say, look, no, we know that on your retail version of this strategy, you can be 20% outside the U.S. Well, we want you to be a little bit high. We want you to be 35% outside of the U.S. because we really want you to look at, you know, the European markets, whatever. So they can draw that up, and they can.
But that makes sense because they have the funds, or they're giving you enough money to be able to basically create your own fund.
Absolutely.
Whereas, as me, I'm giving you $1,000 at a time, right. And I'm not gonna be able to demand that you put
right.
a certain percentage of that somewhere.
Right, and it gives you a little bit. Well, you know, in theory, it gives you a little bit more control of kind of what your return stream is going to be, because, you know. If you're an individual investor, you're looking for what? You're looking for the highest potential return or the highest generating appreciation that you could get based on your timelines, basically, you know, all your risk profile, all those things that you typically go into when you're betting a client. Well, an institution, well, the one thing is they value more than anything, and it's not the highest performance, it's the consistency of the performance. So they don't want to see, well, one thing that will spook a, you know, and I've seen this, one thing that will spook or will lose you a mandate with an institutional client is your sequence of returns. If it's really volatile, if you're up 15% this year, but you're down 7% next year, or you're down 14% this year and down, then you're up 5%. They want consistency, because what they're doing is that they're basically using that plan to pay their liabilities, right? It could be to pay their retirees or to manage those assets for their clients. Or it could be
they have bookkeeping to keep track of. They got plans that they want to be able right. to put that money to.
Exactly. If it's an insurance company, I go back to the insurance company example. Like they know that they have to pay a certain amount of claims. They've kind of projected that out. So, you know, if they want to make sure that they're going to get 5, 6, 7%, you know, maybe whatever their mandate, and that's spelled out too in those guidelines. Mm-hmm. You know, your mandate, Kyle, is to manage our monies. And we're going to use, you know, they're always different, but we're going to use the S&P 500 as your proxy. So we want you to beat the S&P 500 because it's a U.S. mandated, a U.S. Strategy.
Mm-hmm.
We want you to beat that by, on average, 2.5% over, 2% over a full market cycle, 3% over a full market cycle. And that's what they want to see. They want to see you beating it by 3%. Great.
When you say market cycle, are you talking about
like
10 or 12 year period?
No, it's usually about firms define them differently, but it's usually that 3 to 5 year period. You know?
Okay.
So if you've done great this year, that's great. You know, you blew out the ledge. You returned 10% this year. That's fantastic. But they don't want to see you down 7% next year. They don't want to see you down 5% this year. They'd rather see you up,
5 to 7% a year.
5% each year. Maybe you're up 10% this year, and you're only down. You're only up 3% next year. That's what they want to see. It's that consistency of returns that really that will really garner you an appreciation in the institutional space.
A big company doesn't want to get extra money at the beginning of a quarter and then have less the next quarter.
Exactly. Yeah. So what they really value, and I mean, any investor values this, but it's really a focus on large institutions, is they want to see consistency in the investment process. So, you know, if your sequence of returns, or if your returns are really all over the map, you're really, you know, you're really positive 1 year, but you're really negative the next year. Well, you've told me you're going to invest in a certain way, that you use, you know, you're a fundamental investor, and you look at earnings and you look at,
right,
or are you, or you take that dot, right?
Yeah.
You're investing in companies that have strong cash flows, positive earnings projections over the next 10 years. They will grow at a 6% clip. Okay, so that's what you're telling me. So I should see companies in that have that profile, and the performance of that portfolio should be fairly consistent. Positive and negative should be fairly consistent.
Yeah, you better not see AOL or something on that.
Right, right. But if you do see that, right, if you walk in and you're coming up and your client's on board and you're going in and you're doing a annual review, believe me, they'll be happy that you have really strong returns. But there'll be an enterprising board member who'll be like, okay, you generated 17% this year. Like, and we told you that you should be in blue chip companies who are growing at this. Why? And that they're in a market cap between 50 billion and 75 billion. So it's all large cap. But how come I see companies in here that have a market cap of $5 billion? Like, this is not what we signed up for. And that's a bad thing. That's a bad thing.
Would they pull their investment if the...
Well, they'll fire you. They would fire you, yeah. I mean, the way it typically works, this happens in pensions, and you know, you could talk to Eric about this, because Eric's on the Quincy Retirement Board. And
he's on the firing end.
He enjoys it.
He does.
I don't want to get us off topic, but the makeup of public boards, because I, you know, and in a previous life, I've had meetings with them, is a little bit different than the makeup of a corporate board. Okay, it just is. On a corporate board, you may have individuals on that board who have strong investment backgrounds, or are just very familiar with it, so they know the right questions to ask and they know what to look for in a manager. You know, they're looking at manager tenure, manager turnover, how old are your analysts? How many market cycles have they seen? Public board's different. Public board, you have usually, because it's a public, you know, municipal plan in our case. So you're going to have, who are the biggest representatives of that plan? Well, you're probably going to have an auditor on the plan. You're probably going to have a representative from the fire and the police, because they're the biggest constituents of that plan.
Is that why the consulting agencies come in and help out in those situations
exactly.
too?
So... Yeah, you beat me to the punch. So those plans, they both do, corporate plans and public plans, will hire what they call an investment consultant, an investment advisor. Mm-hmm. So obviously people have day jobs on these plans. They're not going to be able to vet every manager and say, all right, well, you told me you fired your last large cap U.S. manager. We've done the vetting. We know the industry. These are the three, four managers that you should look at to take over that portion of your plan. They'll come in, they'll do a dog. I say this derogatory, but it's not. They'll go in and they'll do, I call it a dog and pony show or a beauty contest. They'll go in there, they'll introduce a team, they'll talk about how they manage money, how they pick securities, who the individuals are, how solid a team they are. This has been our performance. This is what's important to us. The investment advisor, investment manager will do that for them. Then it ultimately becomes the board's decision to pick who they want for that mm-hmm. mandate. Same thing on the public side, but obviously, as you've kind of driven out your question, is that they lean heavily on them because most boards aren't made up they're not made up that way, where they have people on the board with that kind of background. You know,
well, and so that I think really drives the next question. Then is like, why did you take this position then if you had such a successful past, just tired of,
yeah,
tired of the
yeah, that, I mean,
the
that,
big
that's
life.
A real big life. It's just a simplistic way. That's probably the best way to describe it. I was at a point in my career where, you know, I wasn't seeing my wife until like 8:30 at night, and then from that point on. I was on the phone, and she's like, I know you like what you're doing. You're doing fine and everything like that. But like, I can't talk to you for the first hour that you're here. And when you're here, you're answering emails. And then there was, travel was involved in too. And, we mm-hmm. got to a point, and I've always, we're a little bit different. It's my wife and I, so we don't have kids. So, our critical mass is different than other people's critical mass, right? So, and neither good nor bad. But I was at a point in my life where I was like, look, I'm not enjoying what I'm doing. My standard of, we would drive. I took my first, I think I ever told you this, I took my first vacation this year. We went to Italy back to see family.
This year was your first ever
real vacation. Like I took a day here and there. We took 2 weeks. I haven't done that probably in like 10, 15 years.
What part of Italy did you go to?
I was in Naples. I was in the Amalfi Coast. So that's where my family's from. That's where my dad was from. My mom's from Sicily. And so I haven't gone back. And
I got family up in Vicenza.
Oh, okay.
In the northern part. Yeah.
That's where we have to go next. I spent most, now I've been back a couple times, but I haven't been back in like 15 years. But we spent most of, we did Rome. We did, but most of the time was on the Amalfi Coast.
I didn't do Rome when I was there. I did Milan and Klagenfurt. I took a train over to Austria while I was there because cool. I just wanted to do something different than everybody else was.
So I was in, so when my previous life, I had this kind of goes to what your question as to like why they make the change. You know, I remember I had to go to Austria on a weekend because we were in a mandate. We were being chosen to be put into a search for a new small cap manager. There was an Austrian, I think there was a pension plan, but it was a fairly small plan. But it was only like a $20 million mandate, which I know it's a lot of money, but it's not a lot when you look at some of these size plans.
Not in the big,
Portfolio manager didn't want to go. Because he didn't think, he's like, one, I don't think they're going to choose us because I don't think they, you know, I think they're more quantitative. They're looking for a quantitative manager. I'm not a quantitative manager. I'm a fundamental manager. So, Rick, why don't you go? So I had to leave on a Friday to, I mean, listen, I just gotten married, but I got to go to Vienna for 3 days. But it was that kind of thing where it was like the travel kind of wears on you after a while. And it's the quality.
Especially when it's last minute like that, too.
Yeah, and there was
always like that.
And there was always a lot of that. Because like when you're on the team as a product person, you're representing the portfolio. You're representing the manager. So you have to be able to, you have to know their investment process. You have to know kind of their methodology and stuff like that. So, and believe it or not, portfolio managers don't really want to travel. They really, you know, think Eric
Mason. Just want to go home and spend time with their wife.
They want to be in their office doing smart, intelligent work, trying to decide which securities to pick. They don't want to have to deal with boards and do the relationship piece. But I did want to answer your question in that, you know, so I got to a point where I thought like, you know, I think we can do this, you know, and my wife was always like, you know, the city is always looking for good financial people. And I always had a good relationship with the mayor Cook. And it was her idea. I have to give her credit. She was like, why don't you take some of your experiences and your backgrounds and do something for the city, work financially for the city, you know? You've lived here all your life. You're probably going to die here. You know, your family's from here. Your family's owned property in the city for a long time. You know, you have a vested interest in this city. You love it. And I said, that was a great idea. So, you know, I met with the mayor a couple of times and he was like, you know, your timing may be right. I'm looking to really reformat and restructure the municipal finance team because I have a lot of things I want to get done.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of told me about some of those things. He said, I really need, to be honest with you, Rick, he said, I need people, we don't have a good bench, you know, because a lot of people are aging, you know, they've been in this job for 30, 40 years. They've one way
just
of doing
it. Happens.
Yep. Yeah. And they don't have a lot of private sector background. So you talked a little bit about the pension and things, and I need people who are familiar with that kind of world. Familiar with markets, familiar with interest rates, familiar with, would that be something you'd be interested in? And it was something I was interested with. And we did the dance for a couple of years. So it took a while for him to, you know, to kind of put his structure in place. But he got to a point we called, I remember it was at the gym.
Was that before he put Eric in or was that right around the time when Eric got his start?
It was right around the time he put Eric in. He had told me this. So, you know, I probably shouldn't say this, but I knew what his plans were. You know, he told me, he said, well, here's my plans. Like, I want to put Eric in as CFO. And I think you guys both have strengths. You both have areas of, you know, areas that.
That's a brilliant team.
Yeah. He said, I think you guys have worked really well together. Yeah. Little did we know we'd become best friends too, but.
Right.
But we did, I think, we complement each other. But it was his vision. He said, look, I need people who have pride. And I remember saying this, like, for what I want to do and the way the city is run, I want to run it like a well-oiled machine. So I think that means people have more of like a different perspective and, you know, how corporations are run or businesses are run. So again, it took about a year and a half. I was at JPM. I really enjoyed what I was doing. I was working with a lot of high net worth clients and then kind of like an advisory role. And I enjoyed it, but it is taxing. Yeah. And I always said to Eric, I was like, you know, I enjoy what I'm doing, but like, You know, here we launched the first blockchain bond. We're building a new school. We're building a new public safety building. We're building new bridges. You know, my other job, I was just helping other people more wealthy. And I'm like, right. That's good. That's a good thing. But I'm like,
it's not a legacy.
No, it is a legacy. I drive home and I see, like, I'll drive home tonight and I'll see the building that we got $200 million is $200 billion to build a new police, fire, you know, state-of-the-art building. That's going to probably be there 100 years. And it's nice to know, like, oh, you made your community a little bit better and you made the city a little bit more livable. And it's a great city, and you see it in the valuations of everyone's home. So that was that was very attractive to me. You know, it doesn't hurt, Kyle, that I have before I had a 45-minute commute, you know, schlepping into Boston or schlepping on a plane. Now I can probably walk home if I wanted, if I had the ambition, in 5 minutes.
Right. So. Oh man, now we definitely got to meet up next time I get down there.
Absolutely.
Is the wife happier though? That's the real question.
She is very. She's much happier. I kid the mayor and I say, like, you probably saved my marriage. You know,
I'm actually happy for you, because I've known too many people, especially in the military, like the Navy guys, that do 20 years and get out. That's when a lot of divorces happen.
Yeah.
People realize that they needed the time away from each other.
There's merit to that thought. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have to be, I think you have to be also, you have to accept, and the role is different. The role is absolutely different. I mean, I'm lucky. I'm dealing with a really great team here. You know, Eric Mason, Paul Delababa, Molly Smith, Lisa Curran, like, these are really smart people. And, like, this office is run, like, I tell them all the time, like, I go to other departments. Don't get me wrong. I think I'm in Xanadu here. Like, I don't think it's not run. Other departments don't run like this. I mean, we have the luxury. I'm down the hall from the mayor. So we're all down the hall from the mayor. So we know exactly what he's thinking most of the time. So, you know, we know what his vision is probably before than a lot of other. I've had engineers that work for the city say that. It's like, you know, you know more about what is probably going to happen than we do, because you're in these kind of informal conversations.
Yeah.
Other departments aren't run like that. Other departments, you may have people who have different backgrounds, who different agendas. So I'm fortunate in that the structure is the way it is. Like the mayor had a vision to structure it this way, because he wanted to carry out a lot of high level, really intricate plans. He got the right person. He hired the right CFO. Eric's like just a really smart guy, a really ambitious guy.
He doesn't strike as ambitious too either, which is I'd love about him.
I'm always, you know, when I talk about Eric to, you know, my wife or whomever, you know, I see the traits in him. It's funny, I've told this a million times, so it wouldn't be a secret. I see traits in him that are very similar to traits I've seen in really, really smart portfolio managers and really, really smart analysts that I've worked with. And that trait is the ability to process, to intake a lot of information, complicated information, process extremely quickly, and to come up with a solution or conclusion. You know, that's really simplistic in explaining that, but it's very hard to do that. It's very hard
to do it quickly and accurately.
To see the big picture. And he has this ability to do that. And I think, you know, and I think that's why the mayor has such confidence in him.
Yeah.
And he's done a great job. And like I said, he's great to work with. He gives me a lot of, I think he throws too many bouquets my way in terms of, you know, you've done a good job on the other, but we work really
That's
close.
Just the sign of a good manager, though. That's somebody who's not, he's not looking for the credit for himself. No. He's just trying to get the job done, and he's trying to make sure his people get rewarded.
No, you hit that right on. He asked me one time, so he got his master's, and he asked me, he's like, and we were talking one time about different concentrations, and he's like, you know, the great thing about an MBA is that, you know, a lot of things because he's an economist by trade, as you know, by background. He's a published economist. He's a professor at West Virginia, teaching econ. And he's like, you know, but the MBA, the solid MBA that gives you kind of that management, those management skills. And listen, I have an MBA. So, okay. But I said, Eric, you're doing MBA work every day, right? Like, you're forecasting, you're projecting, you're structuring teams, you're hiring, you're firing, you're putting performance plans in place, you're putting business plans in place. Like, those are what an MBA will teach you. Like, the softer skill things, like, you know, how to motivate, all those things. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you're a smart guy. You know how to motivate people.
That's just leadership.
That's leadership.
That's easy, too. All you got to do is find what motivates the other person.
Exactly.
And just give them the tools to do it.
And I don't want to poo-poo, like, the academic experience. But I think if you're doing this, unless your company is saying, I need to put your name in a book, so I need you to have an MBA, so go get it. Like,
Yeah. Screw them.
Exactly.
All right. I think that's enough pumping Eric's star.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
I think what we should do, though, is probably let you get back home. Then.
Oh, thank you, Kyle. No, I enjoyed this. I always enjoy talking
to you. I really did, too. But I want to make sure that you actually get home in time to talk to your wife. And
I appreciate that, sir.
Not keep you here till 8 o'clock at night.
That's fine. That's fine.
There's other stuff that you've done. So if people want to hear other podcasts that you've done, because you've done some stuff with The Bond Buyer.
Yeah.
Where else?
We did a podcast with The Bond Buyer. So you can find that on bondbuyer.com. I think that's subscription. Actually, no, I'm sorry. That was one of the benefits. So you can actually download the Bond Buyer podcast that Eric, myself, and Mayor Koch did several months back. We are putting that. Thank you for reminding me, Kyle. We have to put that on. So we own that, or we have access to it. So we can put that on any site that we want to. So I think we're going to put it on the, I think this is something I need to do tomorrow. We're going to put that on the Quincy site, because quincyma.gov municipal finance site. So to be able to listen to it there.
Did you put ours on there?
Absolutely. Yeah. Where's my sticky?
Let me know what you need. I'll send you whatever you need.
Yeah. And we've obviously done, you just said it. We did one with you, which I really, really enjoyed. The Band of Traders. That was fantastic. I actually listened to the one you did with Eric last night.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That was going great until I think we found out that Joel is from Canada. And then
he went on his litany in Canada.
Oh, my God. But that's the fun of talking to Eric. Oh, you never know what you're going to get.
He's fantastic. And we'll also, the articles on blockchain are on Bond Buyer as well. And one thing I didn't tell you, one thing cool, and maybe Eric told you this, but so Bond Buyer does every year, they do a deal of the year, the Bond Buyer bond issuance deal of the year. And there's several categories, right? So there's largest deal, most innovative in terms of technology, largest public deal, largest corporate deal, things like that. And so obviously, you know, we felt, I think we were a pretty good shop on the innovative portion.
Yeah.
So we partnered with JPM on putting nomination papers in. We just submitted it yesterday, as a matter of fact. So we will know if we made the cut. I think it's early November 9th, I believe.
Okay. If you made the cut, let me know, because we'll do a follow-up.
Absolutely.
I want to hear more about that.
And this is one thing. It's a kind of big deal in terms, I guess, in the municipal finance world. So if you win, they ship you out to New York. They have a black tie event where...
Oh, that's so cool.
I know. And Eric was like, I'm not getting into a black tie. I'm like, hey, I'm just telling you.
No, but you can wear that Gregory Peck outfit you got. We could stick Eric in a set of overalls. He could dress up like Tim.
That's true. Yeah, the Gregory Peck, he told you, right? So I have the Beeper Gray suit.
I knew exactly what suit he was talking about when he said that, too.
To Kill a Mockingbird.
I went and looked through every old box I had before this interview to see if I had a pair of overalls. I thought about throwing a set on just to...
Eric, I always say this to Eric. He's the oldest living... Well, now he's 30 years old, but I'm like, you know, he'll get the Kill a Mockingbird references.
Yeah.
I'll talk to, you know, great guys that I work with, you know, they're 30, and I'll make a Godfather reference or an Animal House reference. And they'll be like, where's that from? I said, of course it's from Godfather. And like, what's that? I'm like, what's that? Only the greatest movie ever made, but okay.
Joel is talking about how, you know, in America, they just move south of the border and they drill underneath Canada and steal the oil from that way. I was like, oh, they take your milkshake? Crickets, nothing.
They don't get it.
I never watch movies.
Right. But Eric will get all of them.
He'll get everything from 1950 or before.
That's fair. So I will absolutely. So we've submitted nomination application for our deal, which I feel pretty cool. So, you know, it's the first.
I think you guys should get that.
It's the first in the United States. I mean, that's pretty innovative, right?
Can we vote somewhere?
They have their own. They have their own board.
I'll send some threatening emails.
Indeed. obviously your platform is great, Band of Traders. Not only for what we've done podcasts, but I've listened to your other stuff too. So it's fantastic. So that's an unplug.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I'm so terrible at plugging my own stuff. So I just need to get more people to do it
me. What do they say? You got to toot your own horn, because if you don't toot your own horn, somebody will use it to bash you over the head with it. So you might as well.
Well said. All right, folks, I think that's going to do it for today.
All right, but sir.
Make sure you check out all those amazing links. I'll put everything in there so that way people can check it out. The Bond Buyer podcast, the one that we did in April. Anything else that I'm missing in there?
No, I mean, if you want we have the PDFs on the articles and stuff. The Bond Buyer does a nice article on the deal. Mm. But I can send you the
Adobe. If you can send me that, because I don't think I have. I think I tried to find those articles. Absolutely. And I had trouble. Yeah, if you send me those, I'll stick them in there. But I think that's going to do it then.
Awesome.
Until next time.
Thank you, Kyle. Always great talking to you. Hopefully we'll see each other again soon.
This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It does not constitute financial or investment advice and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations.
Produced by China Shop Productions.